you want to make sure that you're maximizing your ability to learn about yourself, your own abilities and interests, so that you can then pivot toward better match quality. Make a hypothesis of what you need to learn about yourself and choose accordingly.
Welcome to the IDOU Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hello and welcome, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Creative Confidence Podcast. I'm Colita Stafford, Executive Director at IDEOU, and I'm thrilled to welcome David Epstein. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So David is here to talk about being a generalist versus a specialist and which approach leads to more career fulfillment. But before we get into all that, I understand that you actively curate your social media because it's a great way to broaden your creative inputs. And so question for you is, who are some people or organizations you've recently started to follow and why?
Every week I drop and follow three people. And I got this from an MIT study that showed that this helps like idea generation if you're actively curating. So you're not just getting sort of funneled by an algorithm. And so three of my recent follows that I love are Angela Chen, who on Twitter and Instagram, who is an editor at Wired. And just like everything she shares is just fascinating. Like today I was reading a post she shared about a futuristic novel that's written in the form of statements to an HR committee. And she just like made these like really interesting comments about it. So that's a great one. I recently followed a Brazilian artist named Ricardo Juchim. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly because I just follow him on social media, but he's a pixel artist. And I just thought his work is so interesting with constructing these intricate pictures for video games, usually, you know, made out of pixels. And I'm just fascinated to hear him talk about his work process. And finally, a great follow, a researcher I'd followed for a while, but who wasn't really active on social media by the name of Drew Bailey, who's at UC Irvine. And he studies education, basically, and learning, but he's also like a gadfly of research methods. So he's very critical about other people's work and kind of pokes interesting holes. And so he's just become active on social media. And so I found that to be a very generative follow.
Wonderful. I'm going to add one more for everyone to enjoy. And of course, I'm a little bit biased here, but I highly recommend you check out David's Range Widely. So David, you put out a weekly newsletter and it's fascinating, the things, the blend that you bring of ideas. So you can find that at davidepstein.com. I highly recommend you sign up for your newsletter. So let me tell you about David. So we are joined today by David Epstein. David is the number one New York Times bestseller of the book Range. For those of you who haven't checked it out, it is a very exciting read. It's been out for, it came out before the pandemic. So yeah, you have quite a few stories since then.
Yeah. For those of you who haven't checked it out, like get your lives together and get your priorities straight. You know, what have you been doing with your time?
They've been exploring a lot of new generalist things, David.
Fair.
You're also a New York Times bestseller of The Sports Gene. Your background includes everything from host of the Slate's popular how-to podcast, science and investigative writer at ProPublica, and you've been a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. And of course, It wouldn't be a story about generalists if you didn't have some variety in your background too. I understand you've worked as an ecology researcher in the Arctic.
That's right. I lived in a tent in the Arctic.
Of course.
Yeah. As one does.
I understand you've also signed up to work on the D-deck of a seismic research vessel shortly after it had been attacked by pirates.
That's right. I mean, in my past life, I was training to be a scientist at a certain point. The D-deck is the one where the water hits, so you can like never sleep. And it was bouncing sound waves off the ocean floor to image the ocean floor for maybe earthquake prediction and things like that. But the previous year, it had been off the coast of Somalia. And so there were some like bullet marks in some of the equipment on the back of the boat. I was just off the coast of the Pacific Northwest, so.
All right. Well, but anyway, all of these things have come together to be a topic that I'm really excited to talk to you about today. And it's really about how do we talk about short-term and long-term success, in particular, with how it relates to your career. So part of what we're going to cover today is how a generalist approach and mindset helps you be a better problem solver and how it can lead to a very fulfilling career path. So before we go into that, David, I want to set the stage for people who may not be familiar with your work. And there's two big ideas I want to cover first of what this idea of a generalist versus a specialist. And so it's Winter Olympic season. we're all watching these amazing teenage specialists, I would call them. I think we all kind of understand what a specialist is. It's someone who's very, very focused and very elite in their craft or their discipline. So can you paint a picture of what a generalist is? What does that mean?
Actually, I think sports is a great place to start because that it serves as a really useful analogy, essentially, which is why I started the book with sports, where I was contrasting Tiger Woods, I think, you know, maybe the most famous specialist story of development ever, right? He's 2 years old. You can go see him on YouTube on national television showing off his swing. And I contrasted that with an athlete who grew up kind of playing some of everything and spent a lot more time in, you know, volleyball, handball, skateboarding, tennis, basketball, all these different things, and spent more time kind of unstructured activity exploring. And that athlete is Roger Federer, right? And who is every bit as famous as Tiger Woods as an adult. But yet even tennis enthusiasts don't usually know that development story. Or like I talked about some of this once, and Serena Williams was in the audience and I thought she was going to like roast me. And she stood up and goes, my father was ahead of his time. He had us do taekwondo and gymnastics and track and field and ballet. And we had to learn to throw football for an overhand serve. I never knew that, even being a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. And so I thought those were useful analogies because even those people who end up very specialized had this broader so-called, what scientists often call a sampling period, where they compiled this sort of broader toolbox that one, you know, gave them some general skills that scaffold later technical knowledge and an ability to pivot, but also taught them about their own interests and abilities so that they could eventually make sure they have good so-called match quality, you know, fit with who they are and what they do. And so when I think of the generalist, I think of the generalist and specialist, I think of that sort of Roger and Tiger model. Like we all become, you know, focus into one degree or another at some point, but it's about the toolbox you bring to it and the journey in getting there.
Great. So let's talk a little bit more about that toolbox and journey. So back to a specialist, I can imagine, I'm just going to use the athletes again. I can imagine mm-hmm. their learning program is probably very, very focused and specific. A lot of repetition, optimization. What is the learning program or the learning environment for someone adopting more of a generalist approach? Does it look the same or different?
I should say, and the research literature is quite clear, and there's another, if you go back a few weeks and range widely, wrote about the most recent study, a meta-analysis of studies of athlete development that shows that the typical path to elite is actually this early sampling period, and that one of the issues with that, though, and they looked at athletes and Nobel laureates and found that they both tend to, those who go on to the highest level tend to progress a little more slowly earlier in their career because they're doing these broader things. And so they're kind of sacrificing a head start in a way to get this broader exposure and this broader toolbox. And so I think there's sort of two, you know, so first of all, I think a lot of these athletes have had broader background than we tend to think. But the other thing is, I think rather than getting in that environment where, you know, you're doing kind of the same thing over and over and over and over and over and repetition, 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 you have to think about, you know, if you lift the same weights the same number of times every day, again, to use another analogy, you don't get better that way. Eventually, you stop causing the adaptation you want, right? You may not go backwards, but you won't go forwards. So you need to actively start seeking out things that are different than what you've done before. And so even for quite specialized athletes, that can often look like things called variable practice, which translates to everything that everyone does. To give you a good example of what a variable practice in another domain, there's a study from a few years ago where math classrooms, middle school math classrooms, were randomized to different types of math learning. Right? Some of the kids got what's called blocked practice, where it's like you get problem type A, 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 followed by B, 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 and so on. Kids progress quickly. They rate their own learning highly. They rate their teacher highly. Everyone's happy. Other classrooms got randomized to what's called mixed practice, where it's like you took all the problem types and threw them in a hat and draw them out at random. Yeah. Progress is slower, kids more frustrated, but instead of learning how to practice, execute procedures, they're learning how to match strategies to types of problems because it's all mixed up. And when the test came around, the mixed practice group blew the blocked practice group out of the water, studying the same material, but in this mixed up way that caused it to, you know, force them to build these more general models that they could then apply when they were facing new problems on the test. So I think no matter who we are, we need to face this diversity of challenges that forces us to create these more general skills that we can then use for what psychologists call transfer, which is taking that knowledge and applying it in new problems.
So this is kind of a big idea. Just bear with me a minute. So I think a lot of us kind of have this idea of we should focus early. We should just really stay devoted. Mm-hmm. But you're saying there's a trade-off to that where it benefits us for the short term, but it actually takes away what might benefit us in the long term.
To me, that's like the less marketable but true subtitle of Range, which is sometimes the things you can do that cause a head start actually undermine long-term development. And I think that, as you were alluding to, I think that operates at kind of two big levels. One being the learning of a specific thing, where this more mixed up learning that slows you down, that is more frustrating, actually ends up making the knowledge both stickier and more flexible so that you can apply it. Huh. And I also think it operates at the level of again, finding match quality, which is progressing through your experiences in a way that moves you closer and closer and closer to better fit between your interests and abilities and the thing that you're actually doing.
Hi there, Ko here from IDEO-U. Human-centered design is at the heart of what IDEO is known for. Our Insights for Innovation course is an in-depth focus on the first phase of design thinking. It will ground you in the needs of the people you're creating for. You'll learn to develop empathy for your customers and surface insights for creating products and services they want and need. Check it out at IDEOU.com/insights. That's IDEOU.com/insights. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
I love this construct, David. It's actually really liberating. So let's apply it. So being a generalist, it allows you to be, you said, more sticky, allows for more transfer. So let's apply it to something, problem solving. So I understand, mm-hmm. how does being a generalist help you be a better problem solver? Does it? And why?
It does. And again, this is not to say that specialists aren't important by any stretch, but in a lot of really complex problems, it's people who can sort of identify the deeper structure of, uh-huh. of problems that work. So to give an example from some of the research I cite, I was looking at research at Northwestern that studied, you know, students solving different types of problems, basically. And they were given all these different types of problems that were, the window dressing of the problems was from different domains, you know, biology, you know, engineering, whatever it was, all across. And students tended to do reasonably well when the problems were familiar from their major, but poorly when it was outside their major, even if the structure was the same. The exception to that were these students who were in this special program where they didn't have a major, they just had a bunch of different minors, so they sort of learned how each different discipline approached problems. And they were better able to identify the deeper structure of different types of problems and therefore solve things that were unfamiliar to them. And I think that's kind of the microcosm of what we're talking about, is when you build these sort of general models in this broader toolbox, you're more able to identify the deeper structure of a problem before you just dive in and try to like execute procedures that you've done a million times.
That makes so much sense. You know, and so David, I know you've been tracking too, like I've been watching kind of the job market and the skills as they evolve in job markets. And one of the top skills in most industries is the ability to problem solve. And so you've talked about athletes and Nobel laureates, but this is really applicable to everyone. So if you want to start to evolve and improve your problem-solving abilities, one of the best ways to do that is to start to broaden and start to adapt a mindset of looking for kind of structures and abstractions versus just staying in your lane, so to speak.
Yeah, getting outside your lane. I think, and you just reminded me of the work of a woman named Abby Griffin, a professor, and her colleagues on serial innovators, right? So she and her colleagues study people who make like repeated creative contributions that are really important to their organizations over and over, serially.
Yep.
And when I was reading Professor Griffin and her colleagues' descriptions of who these people are, it was like they have a need to learn across multiple domains. They read more and more widely than their peers. They appear to flit among ideas was a phrase she used, which doesn't normally sound like a compliment. They need to network with people outside of their own domain of expertise. They repurpose things from different fields that are already available. They connect disparate pieces of information. These are all like pretty much exact quotes from her work. And in her writing, you can sort of feel this warning that's like, dear HR people, just so you know, when you look only for the square peg that fits for a square hole or define a job too narrowly, you're going to screen these people out because they need to have this ability to kind of be, you know, mobile in their thinking and communicate with people outside of their lane, and that empowers them to do what they do. And I've talked about serial innovators with Adam Grant, psychologist Adam Grant, who maybe a lot of people know his work too. Mm-hmm. And I think he correctly concluded, he said, we don't know if you can create these serial innovator people, but it's pretty clear that you can stifle them. And so if you don't allow them access to this sort of this breadth that they want to accumulate, they'll like leave your organization to go find it somewhere else, basically, if you force them to do that.
I'm going to throw in a question here, David, that I know you're going to want to answer. And this idea, how do you sell yourself in a generalist world where so much value is placed in specialization? And you just said that. So like, let's go with the HR example. Like,
this is the most common question that I get. This is the most common question. And so I want to share sort of personal experience, because the last few years I've been on the committee for something called the Pat Tillman Foundation, which is a foundation named after a pro-American football player who left in the middle of his career to join the Army and was killed in Afghanistan. And this foundation gives scholarships to military veterans and soldiers and military spouses for career development. It's incredibly competitive because they're big awards, you know, like 1-2% kind of win rate. And to my great honor, I've gotten to be on the final selection committee, like with like 3-star generals and special forces operators and these people the last few years. And something that's dawned on me is, say an applicant, a typical applicant who wins, when I look at their resume, even I, knowing what I know, my first reflex is, ooh, this person looks like a little all over the place, right? Because I still have normal human reflexes despite like doing the research range. Mm-hmm. And it'll be like someone who went to high school or college. They graduate, they get a job, they're not fulfilled by it. They join the service. They end up in like some remote area of another country, maybe, I don't know, administering medical care, whatever. And they find out that they're good at something they didn't expect, or bad at something they thought they'd be good at. They're interested in something they thought would be boring. They identify problems they never knew existed. And then they come back and say, now I want to take these things I learned and this problem I've identified and zigzag, you know, and that's what I want the scholarship to do. And sitting in the admissions committee, these zigzaggers, these people with these scattered resumes, end up at both the left and right tail of the score distribution. The ones who look scattered and kind of don't explain it, or even seem to like downplay their zigzagginess, they get sort of lower skills. All these people in the finals, they're all impressive, but they end up lower skills. The people who win, you know, the middle is sort of more normal trajectories. The people who win are these ones who say, I did this thing, learned something unexpected, so then I made this pivot, and then realized I could take those skills and be more impactful in this other place, so did that pivot, and now I want to address this problem. And it's like a light bulb goes on with the committee where we're like, oh, this is how we would want people to behave, pivoting based on their learned experience, not sticking rigidly to their 10 or 20 year plan despite what they're learning. And so those are the people that account for most of the wins. And I think that how you tell your narrative as a series of pivots based on the things that you've learned and how you've used those prior experiences, you can take something that might look like a liability when it's just like a bullet list and turn it into this massive asset that I can tell you is makes a big impression on a committee that's reviewing applications.
David, that is so liberating. You know, I've been criticized that my resume was too wandering, but what I hear you saying is it's important to weave together the narrative of what you've learned and how those pivots have shaped who you've become.
I say it's important for selling yourself. It's also important for you to keep.
Right.
It's something called self-regulatory learning. You should be reflecting constantly on what you learned, what didn't meet your expectations, and how you wield that going forward. Yeah, it's part of so-called self-regulatory learning, which is how you get the most learning out of each thing you do.
Being a generalist as a mindset within your career. So how does it help equip you for like professional landscape shifts? Like the past 2 years with COVID, a lot of people have seen disruptions in their career paths and opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, can being a generalist kind of help future-proof your career? How does it help you in your career?
Yeah, I don't think there's any silver bullet for future-proofing your career, period, generalist or specialist. But I do think there's evidence that having breadth can be especially kind of critical when things are moving really quickly. So I added in the afterword to Range this research that looked in a dozen countries that matched people for... And these were random samples of people from representative of their source populations. It matched people for their parents' years of education, their own years of education, and when available, their national test scores. The difference was some got this more sort of focused, career-focused education, and some got a broader education first. And the pattern was those who got the career-focused education were more likely to get hired right out of training. That was true. But they ended up kind of less first of all, you know, sometimes less good fit, so their growth rates were slower and less adaptable. So when there were shocks to their industry, they would end up either going backward or being out of work for a long time. And so the pattern in 11 of the 12 countries was that the more career-focused people who are, got the career-focused education jump out to a lead in measured by income, which isn't everything, but it's something that's easy to measure. They jumped out to a lead, but then over the course of their work life, they would be caught. And the people who had that broader background would surpass them later on. So again, it was an example of this long-term, short-term trade-off. And I don't think that means we shouldn't have career-focused education. I think we should have very diversified pipeline, but I think we should be conscious of those trade-offs.
Really poignant example. So, David, you have so much rich research. People have asked, like, where can we find some of the sources? So a lot are in your book, a lot on the website.
30 pages of citations in the book.
There we go. You also care a lot about just how to tips and strategies for people. So I want to go into that space. And I want to go through early in the career, middle career. Let's cover a few stages. What would you recommend for people early in their career in terms of things they might explore or do to set themselves up for career success or more fulfillment?
I think the most important thing earlier in your career, and this happened with me in science, is to do things that give you a powerful signal about what it is, you know, where your abilities and interests lie. And so it's not the time to be conservative. And I mentioned some research that kind of models job matching in range. I won't go into detail on that. But basically, I think the only mistake you can sort of make early on, because you just don't know enough yet, right? Like, I write about something called the end of history illusion, which is this psychology finding that everyone realizes they changed a lot in the past, but thinks they're now done, and we always underestimate future change. And the most rapid time of personality change is from about 18 to about your late 20s. So usually when we're telling people, right, like, you have to have it figured out, you're kind of asking them to make decisions for a person they don't know yet, never mind a work world that they can't anticipate. And so I think the only mistake you can make is by doing something that doesn't give you really high signal about who you are and what you want to do. So sometimes what's looked at as kind of reckless, jumping into a high-risk job for young people is the best thing they can do because it gives them really quick signal about how that fits them. So for me, like when I started studying science, I very much thought I was going to find this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That's not what I found.
You're not living on the Arctic right now, David.
I'm not. You know, when I was doing that, I realized I need to ask myself, am I the type of person who wants to spend my whole life learning kind of one or two things new to the world, or shorter spans of time learning things new to me and kind of synthesizing them? And that gave me a very powerful signal that I was more of the latter. And that informed the rest of my career. And so I think really when you're early, you want to make sure that you're maximizing your ability to learn about yourself, your own abilities and interests, so that you can then pivot toward better match quality. So take on something, make a hypothesis of what you need to learn about yourself and choose accordingly.
I loved one of your quotes from your book is, we learn who we are in practice, not in theory.
That's like my favorite line from the book, which is a paraphrase that came from a woman named Herminia Ibarra, a London Business School professor. Highly recommend her book called Working Identity, that's about the reality of how people make work transitions, which is quite different than I think a lot of the most famous public advice.
I love it. Let's jump ahead to kind of mid-career and, well, just in general. So folks who might be thinking about switching a career, this feels very high stakes. Feels like maybe they've missed the boat on something. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of adopt a generalist approach, or how can that mindset or some of those tools help you at that stage of your career?
Yeah, it's interesting because I know we've talked a little bit before about some research I wrote about at 3M, you know, which is one of the most innovative companies in the world. They have to make every year like something like a quarter of their revenue from products that didn't exist 5 years ago. So they're constantly kind of trying to disrupt. And they studied their own 7,000 inventors and found that there were like different profiles of people. They categorized how broad or specialized someone was based on the number of different technological classifications according to the patent office that they had worked in. And so there were these specialists who kind of drilled down into one or a small number. There were generalists who did a large number. There were sort of dilettantes who never got that broad or deep, and they tended not to make much in the way of contributions, whereas the generalists and specialists both made contributions. The biggest contributions were from these people who kind of dipped in and out of areas of specialty. So they did have these areas where they had anchoring, but at a certain point, they would sacrifice increasing depth to take what they knew and bring it over to this other area. So they would end up like authoring patents that merged a whole bunch of different classifications, and they ended up being the most impactful. And what I think that suggested to me was that it's kind of never too late to broaden. And in fact, I think there's reason to believe that people become so kind of inured to their own competence that they cease to realize like how interesting some of the stuff they know would be if they took it somewhere else. So, So again, to use my own example, just because it's an easy one for me to use, I would say I was heading to be a quite average scientist when I was, you know, training in science, quite similar to the people around me. But then I, you know, went to a sports magazine and suddenly those science skills, it was like I was a Nobel laureate over at the sports magazine, you know? And I hadn't realized that how rare that background and valuable it would seem when all of a sudden I was bringing it somewhere where it was seen as something new or seen as creativity and innovation. And so I think there's this thread of creators, whether it's Nobel laureates or technologists, who will take something, like once they've learned a certain amount in one area, they'll then take it and bring it somewhere where it's seen as something totally new. And that's kind of where the magic can happen. And I think mid-career, that's the kind of thing you can really do. And I think that's why there's this surprising finding a few years ago from research by MIT and Northwestern and the Census Bureau that found that the average age of a founder of a fast-growing tech startup on the day of founding was 45, right? That's a surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we usually think of
not
like
a 25-year-old.
No, we usually think of like the Mark Zuckerberg, right? Who said like young people are just smarter. He was 22 when he said that. You don't hear him saying that now, you know? But it's just like the Tiger story. It's not to say his story is not valid, but it is the exception that we treat as if it's the norm.
Yeah. It sounds so easy. So these 3M scientists, they're generalists, they pivot, they apply. So what about imposter syndrome that comes along with being a specialist? Does anyone else struggle with the confidence to believe that you can pivot successfully? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Not only do I think it would be crazy not to struggle with that, but I think one of the important qualities of a good generalist is what I like to call epistemic humility, which is like being humble about how you know what you know. And I think that humility is important. And I think that can be helpful because you bring a beginner's mind into other people's areas and can even help them realize things, knowledge that they take for granted. I think I'd raise my eyebrow at somebody who was just like moving all over and acting too confident. And so I do think that's a challenge. That said, I think it's also invigorating. I think people like doing new things so there's a benefit to that also. And ultimately, I don't think it alters your performance. There are two people I admire hugely who I've talked to about imposter syndrome, one of whom, Shelley Archambault, who was...
She's been on our podcast. Oh, she's okay. Amazing.
Okay.
One of the first CEOs in Silicon Valley, black woman CEO in Silicon Valley.
And she's like on the board of Verizon and all these things.
Yep.
And she talked a lot about imposter syndrome. You know, she didn't fit the mold, and so she felt this imposter syndrome. And so she kept this sort of, she listened to people who supported her. She made sure she had a good group around her, but also felt that ultimately it doesn't affect your performance unless it stops you from doing something you want to do. Neil Gaiman, a writer I love, I've seen him respond to people about imposter syndrome too, and saying the best thing is ultimately it doesn't matter. I feel like, by the time the world sees a big project that I've been working on, I'm already feeling like a completely confused beginner at whatever I'm doing. So I'm in like a perpetual state of feeling like I have no idea what I'm doing and being an imposter. Unless it really stops you from doing something you want to do, then I think it's something that you just, you identify it, you accept it, and you do what you got to do anyway. And I think that's okay.
So David, will you share your experiment book? And then I want to go to late stage career. But tell me a little bit about on that thread of trying things out.
I brought it over because you warned me. This is my current one. It has Alice from Alice in Wonderland, you know, peeking behind the curtain. But I call this my book of small experiments where, you know, I realized that especially if something goes well for you, there's like more pressure to do more of the same thing that you just did, right?
You should just be writing sports, David. If you only listened to that in your career, you'd only be writing about sports, I think.
Well, so my first book, The Sports Gene, was a surprise bestseller. And so after that, I was like very quickly could have signed up for The Sports Gene 2. And in fact, one of my main professional advisors told me this is the safe for work version. You'd be an idiot to let it be 5 years before you have another book out. And in fact, it was six. And I think it worked out great. And so this book of small experiments is something that I keep. Again, I made that analogy to you don't get better by lifting the same weights the same number of times every day. And so when I think about that is I need to find ways to get out of my rut of competence, or economist Russ Roberts calls it the hammock of competence, because it's so comfy that you don't once you get better at something, you don't want to like step up and try something
new. It feels risky too.
It feels risky. It doesn't feel good to try things you're incompetent at. So at least every other month, I put something in my book of small experiments, something I want to test. I want to learn about myself. Am I interested in this? You know, whatever it is, I put it down and then I force myself to find a way to test it. And that can be as small as interviewing someone in a job area that I don't know anything about, or or a physical skill. Like I just yesterday posted a reel of myself trying to learn a new dance skill on Instagram, which is a little bit embarrassing, but I'm glad I did it because that was one of my, it was in my book of experiments. So I forced myself, it's my own accountability. Or something as involved as like taking a class. I mean, I took an online fiction writing class, which was a project in my book of small experiments that was kind of like a revelation for Range. And I don't think it would have turned out as well had I not done that. So I keep that book to force myself to step outside my lane regularly.
Great. Let's broaden out late stage careers. What does it look like to be a generalist in late stage? Or you actually have quite a fondness. You've got some amazing stories of some of the most successful careers are late stage after people have retired. So do you want to share an example of a story of what that looks like?
Yeah, I do. With Frances Hesselbein, who sort of became a personal role model to me. She took her first professional job in her 50s. She had done like various volunteering. She had like worked in her husband's like photography and video store. Like she kind of just like did whatever was sort of needed in her community or her family business. And at the age of 54, takes her first professional job and soon goes on to be the CEO of the Girl Scouts, which she saved, by the way. She you know, tripled minority membership. She added 130,000 volunteers, right? Those are people she was paying in a sense of mission, you know, and not in money. She turned the cookie business into a third of $1 billion a year that kept growing. And she's this remarkable person. She transformed the organization from one that was kind of preparing girls for life in the home to one that was preparing them for careers in math and science. I've got it around here, that one of the badges that came out of her tenure has ones and zeros. It's binary code for girls learning about computers. And she's just this, you know, an amazing person whose sort of life motto is like the opposite of long-term goal setting in a way, which sounds really weird. But her whole motto, she had these sayings that she loved, like do what's needed at the time. She's like, she looks for the problem right in front of her and says, I'm going to do what's needed for this. Instead of like looking way down in the future, and you have to carry a big basket to bring something home, which means like if you keep an open mind, you're going to learn something important from every single experience you go into. And she's just incredible leaders. By the way, she still works in Manhattan most days of the week at a leadership institute that's named after her. And she's 106 now. So as she likes to say, who knows what's next? And she still teaches at West Point sometimes and things like that. But this like opportunistic life that she lived, where she would just pivot to whatever the problem was in front of her, and that caused her to build up this really diverse array of skills. I mean, she had one semester of junior college education, had to drop out to take care of her family. Her predecessors as Girl Scout CEO were like a woman who started the Women's Coast Guard Reserve and a university dean and all these things. So she didn't have that kind of specialty, but I think that actually made her open to the fact that she needed to sort of have a broader network of people she listened to and gathered information from, because she herself couldn't pretend to contain all of the knowledge and information that she needed. And she's just, I mean, maybe the most famous management guru ever, Peter Drucker, called her the best CEO in America and said she should take over GM and all these things. And I just think it's like, I just wish her story were, Frances Hesselbein is her name, Frances Hesselbein. And I wish her story were better known. And because I think she's emblematic of this kind of short-term opportunistic pivoting that a lot of people who end up with good career fit and a broad toolbox go through.
An inspiring story. David, I have one last question for you. And I did want to just recap a little bit of where we've gone today, because we've covered so much. So some ideas: start a book of small experiments, test out your hypotheses, curate your social media, start to broaden your creative inputs. I think a lot of us really resonate with learning to tell the story of your narrative, of how you pivot, why, what you learn. Obviously, have a hobby. Nobel laureates all have hobbies that are outside their craft.
Somewhat unrelated to your work. Yeah, because actually, if you have a hobby that's too closely related to your work, it decreases self-efficacy a bit.
There you go.
So something unrelated.
And I think the big, big construct that all of us could really start to practice and tune into more is this long-term versus short-term. Like, what are you trading off for short-term gains where maybe slowing down and maybe being a bit inefficient actually has long-term benefits, especially around career? That's a head tilt if I ever heard one. I really appreciate the conversation. David, this has been so amazing. For those of you, if you'd like to learn more about this topic, of course, I encourage you to check out David's book. At IDOU, we teach a course on insights for innovation, and it's all about tuning into customer needs to get to more human-centered solutions, like using generalist approaches to how you problem solve. So I encourage you to find out more at that at IDOU.com/insights. And my final question for you, David, is just general advice for your younger self or just anything that came up from today's topic that you want to leave people with today.
Yeah, there's something that I've been thinking about. And again, I just wrote about it in my newsletter because I just finished a book called The Power of Regret, which is Dan Pink's new book. And because I think self-regulatory learning, again, which is the biggest component, is doing active reflection. We don't do it enough. When you learn something, what did I learn? What didn't meet my expectations? Where do I want to go next? Why? Who do I need to help me get there, et cetera? Like, answer those questions in a journal every month.
Okay.
Doing that reflection in the context of Dan's book, as I've been thinking about regret, it's been something that I think people like push away a lot, when in fact, I think a lot of the research suggests it can become your most powerful teacher if you view it as something like, how do I use this to improve decision-making the next time? And so there's also interesting research about how like negotiators who have regrets then do better in the future than those who didn't. And so I think systematizing that
habit,
some people do this self-regulatory learning just intuitively, most people don't. So having a practice for it, and I think making sure that you don't push away regret, but actually use that to inform your future pivots is something that I myself am working on right now and just wrote about this week.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you, David. I think we're all feeling a little more inspired to sample and try out some things that maybe we've pushed aside. I know I'm going to.
Pleasure's mine.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thanks so much for joining us. If you like what you're hearing here, you can find so much more by subscribing to the Creative Confidence Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you like to listen. We're excited to keep fueling your creativity.